Welcome to Ever Beyond.
Broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network.
Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond.
Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
You're listening? Yeah? No. Oh, that's right. That's right. You're listening, but I wasn't listening. I had my headphones muted. There we go. Just adjusting the microphone. Move it up here. Hello, everybody. Yeah. Peanut butter. You know, that was an interesting thing. You know, how do you, what does your voice sound like inside your head? Does it, you know, does it have a lisp? Does it, you know, have any speech? Does it have an accent? What is your accent? Yeah. I have the greatest fear that my inner voice's accent is French Canadian. Cause that was my dad's voice anyway. So, you know, it's like some people have their mother's voice or their dad's voice in their head. So yes, here we are. I've no guest, so you can be the guest. I'll probably talk about the Rays, cause I don't want to talk about the world situation cause it's getting insane. Wow. You know, who'd have thought that, people would be attacked by the police for voting. I mean, that's just weird. Anyway, the world gets weirder. And as the world gets weirder, the weird turn professional. Those outcasts and vagabonds who have been wandering are now finding a place in the world because the world has kind of caught up. So maybe, well, look, call in if you want to talk to me. If you want me to do a ray reading, or any other conversation that we can have, you know, we can release one of your traumas if you like. That's always a fun one. So particularly open evening since it's the first, and I had no one prepared. So please call in on the station number 775-773-3431, or. Now, I don't know if it's going to work, but I have a new number. And so let's try that one, which is, if I can find it, where did I put it? It's a 1-800. No, can I get in there? There's nothing there. 1-800-FREE, I put it up here. I've just connected with this OnSip thing. So, it's like miles away. It's 1-800-FREE-411. Yeah. So 1-800-FREE 411. See if anyone can call in. I've no idea what it's going to do. I've got the software application running here, and hopefully it should work. If not, well, I don't know. Somebody give it a go, you know. All right, I'll write the number down. 1-800-3-411. I'm not sure if it's gonna work, but give it a go. Can anyone do I live on the coast? Yeah, I live about 7 miles from the coast. This is north of me. It's not strictly a coast. It's the Murray Firth, so it's not really on the open sea. It's a sea within a sea within a sea. Yeah, it's a it's an estuary that is on the North Sea. So massive flooding. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, give it a go with that number. I think that's the number. We'll see. It's a new service called OnSip. But, hang on a second. Well. Yes, or even test that number. So, yeah, 1-8. Oh, no, that's not, it's not 1-8000, it's 1-800. Like an idiot. I'll try again. There's me in a voice. Yeah, 1-800-3-411. Cool. I hope it works. Well, we'll see what happens. See if anybody's, you know, want to come and say hello. And, if anybody's got any news, I mean, what's going on? I mean, there's so much going on in all different parts of the world. We were kind of, it's the sort of time that we've been, waiting for, you know, almost expected, because everybody's been talking about all whatever the prophet, or forecasters have been saying that, the elites were going to create some sort of chaos, and they seem to be creating chaos all over the planet. And I think the idea is that it's going to get overwhelming. They're going to try and overwhelm everybody. So stay calm. Stay on top of it. Just stay on top of it. Yeah, the South will sink. Yeah, well, yes, flooding. Where does all the water come from? That's what I want to know. It's not like the Earth isn't expanding. Yeah. So, I can't see anybody's called in yet. Nobody's called in on Skype. You can call in on Skype on Wolf Spirit Radio. You can use, Wood Pigeon. That number is an ad for a phone service. Alright, okay. Right, okay, so how do I get my phone? totally useless. Alright, I could try. I'm available. Settings. Maybe that was in my settings. Oh! No, there it is. Oh, it's gone. Oh. I had it on. It was one moment. The number was there, and then the screen went blank again. Oh, I've got to log in again, have I? I've been logged out. Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, there we go. I've got to log in again. All right. Hang on. Hello. Hello. How are you doing?
Oh, there it is.
Okay, JP. I'm doing it. This is Pat.
Hi, Pat. There's one more. There we go.
Okay. Can you hear me now? I turned off the
volume. Oh, yes. Much better.
There you go.
Much better. How are you doing?
I'm overcoming my nervousness about talking in public.
Well, let's talk about colorblindness and stuff like that for the moment. You know, it's interesting, and because I heard years ago that there was a way of generating, of getting perfect pitch, of being able to tune your guitar to be note perfect, and it had to do with being able to visualize a color. Which I also have problems with. So, and then that got us onto the whole frequencing thing. So, do you want to springboard off that, Pat? Pat, by the way, is Doran P in the chat room.
Yeah. Well, let's see. The way I understand it, you're familiar with neurolinguistic programming?
I've heard of it. It's to do with the frequency of words being able to reprogram your thoughts and things like that. And essentially it's all for good or evil, you know.
Exactly. It's actually was developed by the deep state as a mind control structure. And that's one of the big things that they use all over TV. And I used to, way back in the day, 40 years ago, I used to know the people that created neurolinguistic programming, and I was one of the first certified neurolinguistic programmers in the world. And the people that taught me actually bragged about being assassins for the CIA, for example. And, you know, so I had exposure to all of this, you know, from way, way, way back. And, it's a lot of it is all about frequency. Plus, one of the original founders of that, I'm not going to say his name, but he was a musician. And, I kind of got the musician's angle on how all these things come together. And he used to say, colors are not something you see. Colors are something that you do. And I didn't understand that at first, but over the years I came to see that what color is frequency. And, you know, the word for a color is simply, you know, a word, a sound or a symbol that we assign to a frequency that if we perceive it through our eyes. And there's something called synesthesia where we all naturally have the ability but are basically educated out of being able to exercise that ability or be aware of it. But we all have the ability really through synesthesia to translate information from one sensory system to another. And so that's how come, like, you know, you were talking about, like, the sea, you know, has a particular color. And if you get the colors, if you see the colors, you can actually play the colors and play music and make me, and usually people who are very, you know, artistic are more in touch with this synesthesia ability. Am I making sense?
You know, I've always wondered, well, I haven't always wondered, I only just started wondering just a few seconds ago, so I haven't really always wondered, but hasn't anybody ever made a rainbow-colored keyboard where like a piano keyboard, you could probably just do it with acrylic paints, but to color the keyboard with the same colors as they correspond to in reality, because that's an esoteric hidden doctrine, this whole thing about which color corresponds to which note. And there are several systems, and a lot of them are confusing because they're deliberately confusing because they're, you're not supposed to, you're supposed to be able to have to figure it out yourself.
Well, absolutely. And as you were saying that, you know, I just actually started visualizing all of the Walt Disney produced children's, you know, shows and videos and movies and music stuff for little kids these days. And, you know, that's your school and all of that right there, because I watched and you know, as we speak, my granddaughter is being programmed with all of that. And, you know, like I was saying, back in the day, I actually used to know someone that was literally paid in excess of six figures, seven-figure area for writing hypnotic suggestions into the dialogue on television shows and movies. I mean, that's big business now. That's how Aaron Spelling made all his money. He had people hypnotized into buying the products that he advertised on his shows. And everybody knows about subliminal advertising, but at that time they didn't know that that was being put into the actual dialogue in the shows. But the point I was making, you're absolutely right. If you look at any of the children's, they're all full of rainbows. They're all, sequential. It's all visual music that, you know, backs up, matches, or reverses, you know, what's actually being said overtly. This is all part of, mind control. I will also say that my mother had a cousin who was actually co-won the Nobel Prize in chemistry way back, and I guess it was the 50s, for co-inventing color television. And he worked at a research institute. It was either here in Houston or in San Antonio where television, color television was developed. And it was common knowledge in our family that he said that television was invented as a tool for mass mind control from the beginning. It was never invented for entertainment.
So, entrainment rather than entertainment, huh?
I'm sorry, say again?
Entrainment.
Yes, yes, that's it. Well, I mean, you think of the word entrainment.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking you somewhere. Television. Tell-a-vision. You know, it's taking you somewhere to their vision, and they're putting that inside you.
Exactly.
Exactly. Somebody did tango. All that Disney stuff is subliminal evil. That's absolutely true. And again, you know, family matters. It's a relative, close relative, very, very close relative of mine who worked in Hollywood, and it was the goal of his life. He loved Walt Disney and wanted to work for Walt Disney, but he never could because he was a drug addict. And after Walt Disney died, his brother and rest of his family took over Disney, and they wouldn't let anybody work for them that could not pass a drug test. But that family member has been very connected, you know, with Hollywood and the deep state and the very, very deep state. And I'm getting too close to things I ought not to talk about. So let's go back to colors and frequencies.
Exactly, exactly. See, it's all connected. Everything connects. Go ahead.
I'm not by nature secretive, so it's hard for me to, you know, edit myself as I go along.
Yeah, it's good to be circumspect and abstract, to not speak so particular and be general, and then... rather than saying General so-and-so, you could say, well, people, a military person, you know, so see, get really distant from it, you know. Obviously, you know, if you're right in the middle of it, that's hard because it's like, oh, yeah, I saw this and, you know, yeah. But anyway, meanwhile.
Yeah, I thought I was ground talking about 40 years ago, but then all of a sudden it was coming back up to today, so I had to back off. what I was saying was, about colors and vibrations, and absolutely it's true. And if you really think about it and watch, you know, like people like Barbara Streisand, who supposedly was tested at the same research institute I was tested at for what was called tonal memory, which actually they interpreted as good taste. That she was the only person they ever tested that came close to my score on this test. And if you look at people like Barbara Streisand, that have either perfect pitch or close to perfect pitch and tonal memory, they're going to have good taste in everything they do because they're not going to really tolerate having discordant colors or shapes, or, you know, being in a room full of discordant vibrations coming from the people around him. I think that's probably why Barbara Streisand has trouble doing live performances.
Exactly.
Probably sensitive to the energies being projected from her audience members. And if she gets around people that have feelings of jealousy or resentment towards her, you know, it'd probably knock her on her butt. So
she would feel it. You know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because, it's like we have an inner sense of balance. You know, you walk into a room and you see a picture that's off and it's like, and, you know, after a while, all this, you know, it becomes too much and you have to go over and sort of correct the picture. Just push it up a little bit.
Yes.
Make sure nobody notices, you know.
I have been known to walk into a room and within 5 minutes have to go up and straighten up pictures that are hanging on the wall crooked and things like that. Because, you know, after a while, nobody else notices and it's like annoying the heck out of me. So, you know, some of us are just blessed that way, I guess. Because it is both a blessing and a curse, depending on the context.
Yes, indeed. So, hearing a disc, I have a friend. He is a musician, and he can't stand anything being out of tune, which is a real pain for me because I play a guitar that's got one of those things called a whammy bar, a tremolo arm, and it means that the guitar's never in tune. You have to kind of bend all the strings back in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Django's talking about Streisand being very arrogant. Yeah, well, you see, this is what you're talking about, because if you've got that sense, people might regard you as arrogant because nothing is good enough unless it's absolutely perfectly in time and in tune.
Absolutely. But it's also true, and I think I know this from what I've read about her history, that there's also something called reaction formations in psychology, where if a person, you know, has extreme talent and they get somewhere, there's usually a part of them that feels inadequate or has this fear of exposure that somebody's going to find out that they're not all that, you know what I'm saying? And so sometimes they overcompensate by copying an attitude, you know, that people interpret as arrogant. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of different angles to that. What does it say here? B*CH attitude. Yeah.
So there we go. So, like, actually, this is brought up a little bit of kind of thing here in the chat room. Where's my mouse gone? Come here. I'll have to put trails on. I keep losing where my mouse is located. Hello, guys. Everybody's saying, oh yeah, guilty to a picture straightening. Yep, I'm a picture straightener, even in other people's homes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, here's a good one. You just walk. You don't think left and right, right, left, right. That's a fact. I mean, I had the hardest time learning how to read left to right. And it wasn't until fairly recently someone pointed out to me that in past life, I was a member of a Chinese dragon family. And, you know, they don't write left to right. And I've always, I mean, you know, when I first look at writing, I'm quite slow. When I originally learned how to read, I had to learn how to speed read because I could not make my eyes focus to go from left to right because I didn't have handedness established. I was what they labeled ambidextrous. I was telling somebody earlier in the chat that when I was teaching school, to get the kids' attention, sometimes I would go to the blackboard and take chalk in each hand and start writing with both hands at the same time, writing two different things. And that would get their attention. So there's a handedness and just, you know, and seeing things left to right or, you know, you end up, I was saying earlier that I think dyslexia is the norm and that we're basically educated out of that. And somebody had suggested something about a connection with that and mind control, that dyslexics are less susceptible to mind control. And I was saying, well, I think that's a result of the mind control not working, because I think we start out all dyslexic. And, you know, and I think that probably has something to do with how our planet vibrates, you know, how consciousness interacts with each other on this particular planet. Now, I could be wrong about that, but that's something that just occurs to me. What do you think, JP?
Well, we have, here's the thing. I have weird theories, right? And I know that nobody agrees with most of them. but I have these weird theories. One of them is that there was a planetary near miss 3,500 years ago, and that the planet actually stopped rotating and started spinning in the opposite direction.
Okay, and, well, that would be a possible explanation then.
And that languages that are ancient, that came from before that, go from mm-hmm. right to left. Yeah. And that languages, because that's the way the sun goes. And languages mm-hmm. today, if you look towards the sun, it goes from your left to right. So mm-hmm. our languages follow the sun. And if you're on the equator, perhaps it just goes overhead.
Yeah, and I would suggest that since, you know, the Illuminati thing is an occult or secret knowledge, that they probably know all of this and have, you know, taken full advantage of that information.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think this is one of the great traumas of this planet that we've experienced. It's the thing that is in the Bible in the story of Exodus. You know, the story of Exodus is a history of what happens when you get a near flyby with Nibiru. All these 10 plagues and all this stuff is flying into the tail of this planet.
Huh. That's very interesting.
Yes. And this is not like secret knowledge. It came from Emmanuel Velikovsky. Yeah, he was like around the same time as Einstein and all these people. And he looked at the astronomical, you know, astronomers writing down numbers, boring stuff, astronomical details of all these different societies in China, in Peru, and in Europe, and whatever data he could get from the astronomers from the time, from these places. And he correlated it all. Sure enough, you know, there was something weird went on 3,500 years ago. What's that make it 1500 BC? And I believe that was the end of the Pharaonic Empire. It was the Santorini volcano. Volcanoes erupted. There was dust. There were meteors. There was crap flying. You know, everything. It was chaos.
Just, hey, huh?
and the story of the here's one. All right. So between the Sinai Peninsula and Saudi Arabia, there is a land bridge under the water. You know about this, I bet.
I've heard this.
Okay, so what the story of this goes is that the planet or the body that is passing causes the water in the Pacific Ocean to be drawn to a peak, thus draining the shallower waters.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the waters receded, and that is the spot where Moses and his bunch of Hebraics or whatever you might call them, because they're not the Hebrews anyway. So there's another story. But
yeah, I've heard that one too. Yeah.
But there was and there is evidence. So they go across there, and they end up in a place called Medina. Now what then happens is that the planetary pull is released and the waters come flooding back, presumably a little more violently. Thus, whoever was pursuing these people, because they stole the bloody pyramid, they stole the thing from the pyramid that made it work. And the pharaoh was a bit angry about that, so he sent his men down there, and they were chasing him. And then the waters came back as the planet passed over. It was a bit of a losing battle all around. Pyramid. Same, right? It's got the same number of syllables. Chariot wheels, not pyramid wheels.
Yeah.
Like an alien. Anyway, That's just, I must stop calling myself an idiot. Don't be stupid calling yourself an idiot. All right. The bottom of this, where this land bridge is, has been, you know, they threw a sub down there. And, of course, you know, they've got, chariot wheels and hubs and, axles and all sorts of stuff that you'd expect if there was a, you know, that story happened.
Stuck in the mud, so yeah, to speak.
Yeah. So in terms of that sort of stuff, there's stuff in the Bible that's like, it's a story told in those days of a natural event, you know, a natural disaster that happens quite rarely, but that's why you need to write it down, because people have a tendency to forget that that's happened before, and they don't know what happens to, they don't know what to expect the next time around. So here we are. What do you think about that, Pat? Is that why, is this why you're here?
Who knows? I haven't been able to figure that out. For most of my life, I've thought I'm here simply to be a scratching post for evil. So, you know, that's my, you know, thumb in my mouth feeling sorry for myself point of view. But what I was thinking in terms of neurolinguistic programming and the Bible stories, you know, the problem for folks like me is, you know, there's so much evidence that, you know, the Bible's been messed with, especially the New Testament, well, even the Old Testament, that there was monkey business afoot and a lot of it's bullshit. However, what I learned from neurolinguistic programming is no one can lie 100% of the time. It's not possible. So that's how come discernment is so difficult and yet important, because, you know, no matter how much a person even tries to tell the truth, they can't do it 100% of the time. We're just not 100%er kind of beings. And if, you know, even if we're trying to be truthful, we're not going to make it 100%. And then there's all those people out there, yeah, the Bible was written by the controllers. Well, not all of it, because the controllers couldn't lie 100%. They have to wrap their lies in truth. And I think Gordon Duff from Veterans Today, he admits that there's a certain percentage of information that goes out from the deep state. A certain percentage of it has to be the truth to get anyone's attention. And if you don't have enough truth to wrap your lies around, the lies don't take. And I think one of the things that's going on now is people, whatever's going on in this cyclical thing got them, you know, leaving Egypt and crossing, you know, the sea and everything is an increase in awareness and consciousness, and so the BS that the Egyptians were slinging or whatever just wasn't flying like it had before, and you know, people were trying to get away from that.
There was
I don't know if that makes sense to anyone, but
there was a lot going on at that time.
Yes.
You know, it's very much like, you know, what's going on right now. This is why I keep saying it's, you know, a very similar thing. So here's my take on, like, people say, oh, the Bibles, it's the same as the, you know, that story comes from Gilgamesh and da, da, da. Well, here's the thing. Here's, if you put it into a context, right? So, all right, they might not have been slaves. Bondage could also mean contracted, under contract, subcontracted, just that.
Oh yeah, the whole concept of
contracted artisans who did all the nice frilly work on the pyramids, you know, and in these tombs, they did all that stuff. They were great at that. They could paint, they had music and everything. Anyway, they, you know, they basically stole or were given the gravity generator. And if you got a gravity generator, you can do all sorts of things. It's like a, you know, it's a key technology. So What's interesting is there's poles through the Ark of the Covenant, but they're not to hold it up with, because if you look, it doesn't make sense. You'd have them on the bottom. You're actually to hold it down, because it's a gravity generator, like a UFO. It's floating in the air.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. It also repels water. So that's what, do you remember there was a story where they were in the Jordan and, they had to cross the Jordan as well. So they just schlepped the thing in the, I'll speak in English again. they brought the Ark of the Covenant to the water and it repelled the water, so much that they could walk through it. It created a bubble under the water.
Yeah, yeah. Where they repelled the water, making a place for them to go. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I've been listening lately to some of Cliff High's interviews.
Oh, yeah.
And he just on a few days ago where he was referencing, the electric sun and the true structure and function of the earth as a consciousness, as a conscious being, and the whole thing about how he says there's two kinds of gravity. I don't want to try to speak for him because it was the first time I heard some of the things he said, so I want to kind of ponder it for a while. But basically the idea being that caught my attention was that what the sun is electric, and electric energy is like a lightning, and it comes out from the sun, and it is attracted to Earth, which is a female energy, and it's the interaction, at least in my mind at this point, between the masculine sun and the feminine Earth that somehow is involved in creating gravity. And I don't know how to speak to that more than that, because I keep getting sidetracked visually in my head by literally, you know, the sun is having hot sex with the earth.
To be fair, it's having the same thing with all the other planets. It loves them all equally.
Well, exactly, but I think it's that male-female polarity, that's involved there. And I guess I've heard that some of the planets are female and some of them are not. I don't know. But, it's that image that kind of gets me sidetracked, because then I'm like, woo! and it seems to have sort of a truth, because, I mean, if you think about it, as above, so below, the Elizabethan system of correspondences. What's going on that level is what goes on between, males and females making babies or plants.
Atoms and nuclei.
Any kind of creation, at least in this universe, seems to involve an interaction between male and female energies, and I would suggest that technology is where gravity comes from, and probably all of the generally known definitions of gravity are just total BS.
Here's the thing. I was actually talking to my friend this afternoon about this. All right, so another one of my weird beliefs is that gravity is actually levity, in that it's a repelling force, not a sucking force. And that we are pressed down, and the gravity, so Simon Parks has also said something to a similar effect, that gravity is created by the interaction of the sun and our atmosphere. So that's the same thing as what Cliff was saying there.
Similar, yeah. I think on the same track, because and from what I understood initially on first listening to this latest interview of his, it's like the levity comes in because it gravity is basically, because it's an interaction between two kind of energetic forces, of polarity, that is how things are created. And probably also, if you manipulate that relationship, that's how you can manipulate gravity. And most of the logical explanations for, non-combustion engines, off Earth or even around Earth, travel is to have a propulsion system that does not rely on, sitting on a piece of dynamite and having it blow up under you to get you where you want to go. That doesn't even make any sense.
Pat.
But that's what we've been saying, that's how, NASA operates.
Well, that's one part of NASA anyway.
Yeah.
Now,
and there's the P that is supposedly a fantasy.
I wonder if we can move into this area here, because this is one of my favorite areas. It's a few years ago I discovered a book called Die Glocke by Kelsey Bowman. And it was it's the journals of a person called Otto Cerny.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know who Otto Cerny was?
I've heard of this story, yeah, and I've heard of that book, yeah.
Yeah. So I read it out, and you can download it from my website, Ever Beyond Radio, with my terrible German accents. It was great. It was, I'd only just started it, and I read the first chapter, and I had a German girlfriend at the time, and I said, is that pronounced right? And she said, no. So it's got all the pronunciations wrong on the first chapter, but I get them better at the end, because I was saying his name was Ziga, and I was saying Ziga. And she said, no, it's Ziga, because S and Z is the other way around, So it's just crazy. Anyway, so there we go. Here we go. Time traveling Nazis. Yeah. So basically, they were experimenting using a compound of mercury that they'd obtained the recipe from extraterrestrials from Aldebaran.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? So have you got any – do you know anything about the – whatever happened to the Vril Society?
Well, I've heard various versions. One of them was that, the Bell landed someplace in Pennsylvania, and and then the fun ensued. Another version I heard was they split to Aldebaran. Another one I heard was that the Vril Society really was inner Earth people pretending that the people that the Vril were interacting with were not really from outer space, but were from inner space, inner Earth. So I don't know what the reality is. I don't have any personal experience in that regard, except to say in general, it is perfectly clear to me from my own experience at this stage of my life that in no way did the Nazis lose the war. They never surrendered, and I believe they actually won the war. And the way they won it was to sacrifice the German government of the time, because the Nazis never surrendered. Only the German government surrendered. And I think they partially moved to Antarctica, possibly off-planet, the whole moon and Mars thing. And I think that they're ruling the world now through corporations.
I thoroughly agree. We both have some weird views. Some people would think that's a weird way of looking at it, but I think that's, that's totally on target.
Well, having worked at NASA, in Houston here, I can tell you from experience that there are aliens involved in our space program, the entire NASA, this whole place around here is, was built by and for Nazis. The first director of the Johnson Space Center, was Wernher von Braun, who was Nazi, and several other high-level SS people, whose names aren't popping in my head at the moment. But this place always has been, still is. And here's the connection that I think a lot of people are not getting. These high elite Nazis, were also all Freemasons. And, you know, so you have to factor in who the modern Scottish Rite Freemasons are. And that's where it gets really, sick, twisted, and scary. And I don't think it was any accident that when they built Space Center Houston, the contract went to Walt Disney Studios. Even though their bid for the contract was much, 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 much higher than anybody else's, they still got because, you know, Walt was a big, huge Freemason, and all of the Disney, as I understand it, all of the Disney, Walt Disney, Disney World, blah, 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 all those entertainment parks, they all have what they call the 33 Club, where you have to be a 33rd degree Mason to get in the club. So these things are all connected, and I think people are getting various and sundry of the pieces, but I don't know how many people are seeing how they're all connected together and what's feeding the beast. You know, like, for instance, I don't think people are noticing the connection between the Nazis and the Freemasons. I don't think people are noticing the connection between the Freemasons and the Jesuits and the Vatican. And that really loses most people because, you know, that's really hard. How do you go from Nazis to the Pope? You know what I mean?
In one fell swoop that he was ordained by the Vatican at the time, Hitler, in his travel to Argentina, and he became Father Crespi by going through the seminary all in the Vatican, and then shipped off by submarine to Argentina, so I hear.
Well, that, you know, makes perfect sense to me, and I know Pius the 12th was thought to be a Nazi, and, you know, it just goes on and on up to the present time. Here I'm going to go drop something that I hope doesn't get me in trouble. I'm wondering how many people know, my voice is going, maybe I'll not to say this. I'm going to try anyway. There is a Jesuit priest, on the, staff, at the Johnson Space Center, who has a very, very big, huge salary and no assigned duties.
Just so, there to spy on everybody. Because there's always a Jesuit priest. There was one at the meeting of the extraterrestrial in the 40s, wasn't there?
I started researching this back when that so-called Arabic psychiatrist supposedly pulled off this terrorist attack near here, I can't think of the name of that town, help me out here, not Waco, here in Texas, several years ago. What is the name of that town?
Well, one of these fort things.
Yeah, it turned out it was a false flag. I'm not real computer savvy, but
wasn't
I got
it Fort George or something, or Fort, well, it's not Fort George, but Fort something? I thought
Fort Hood.
Fort Hood,
yeah,
there
right.
You go.
Okay, well, I started playing around, and Google hadn't scrubbed, the information yet, and I actually saw lists that showed stuff about this guy, number one, that he was a psychiatrist, number two, he was employed by the CIA, so he's probably for sure not in prison right now, and also what was going down. The Chinese were at Fort Hood to collect the interest on the money that Clinton had borrowed from him, and they didn't and they didn't want them to have time to be able to check to make sure the gold bars were real. And it turned out they just loaded them all up and flew off during all of this hullabaloo. And they got back to China, and it was all, you know, fake. It was just
salted,
you know, titanium with gold plated on top. And, yeah. And, but it was like a cover for that. And, but while I was looking that up, something popped up on the screen about, you know, this, Jesuit being, a big mucky muck at NASA. And, you know, since I live in the neighborhood, I thought that was very interesting. And then since then, I've just learned a bit more about the connection and the history of the Jesuits and the Freemasons, you know, going back to Adam Weishaupt, who basically started the modern Scottish Rite Freemasons, and way back to the Ignatius Loyola, who founded the Jesuit order, who was actually not Catholic. He was a Jew from Spain. And so, you know, the whole history of the world is so full of, you know, truth and lies, and it's such a big challenge to try to figure out what is what. I think that's the biggest challenge for humans right now, is to just try to sort out, you know, what's real and what isn't, because the whole thing about all these bad guys in charge is they're psychopaths. And psychopaths are great liars because they have no conscience. You know, if a person has a conscience and they tell a lie, they're going to wince. They're going to avoid eye contact. They're going to let you know somehow that, you know, they're not telling the truth. But with a psychopath, man, they're real good liars. I'm almost for myself anyway. If I meet someone and I find them perfectly charming and intelligent, the first thing I think of is what agency do they work for? So, you know, this whole thing about discrimination is very challenging. And I think a lot of people just get overwhelmed and get up and, you know, just avoid thinking about it, which I don't think hiding our heads in the sand is very good, because it leaves our butts up in the air ready to get kicked. And that's what's happening to a lot of people. You know, they just keep, and sooner or later, maybe enough people will get tired of having their butts kicked around that they'll get their head out of the sand and, you know, get up some courage by going into their heart. Here's my thing about the word courage. It comes from the French courage, the place or time of the heart. So if more people thought with their hearts, instead of between their ears or instead of with their guts, their intestines, then I think we'd be much further ahead. So I'm hopeful that this change is going to bring more people into our hearts and make it safer to go to our hearts. Because, you know, how many of us have had our hearts broken more than once, you know?
In the last week,
it's
yes.
In the last week, yeah, exactly. So, but that's the challenge, you know, how to be like a Timex watch and be in the heart at the same time, you know, take a licking and keep on ticking it.
Well, let's take a little break right now. We're at the top of the hour. I also have another guest that I'd like to bring in, and so it should be interesting to hear the interaction of you two. Next track, this is called Skin Deep. It was written by a friend of mine. I'm performing on this with the electric guitar, and the squiddly sound that you're hearing in the background is one of Billy Meyer's recordings of the Pleiadian Beamship. And it's all in 4/3/2. This is like ultra thingy, whatever, you know, the real JP Sears thing. Anyway, so here we go. Skin Deep by F Jams.
Thank you, JP.
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. And welcome back to Ever Beyond. And, oops, I lost both of them. Skype seems to be doing that at the moment. It, you know, you have, You add somebody to a call and you lose the entire call.
The person you have dialed can't take your call now.
Yeah, I know, I'll stop. Hello. Gwyneth, are you there?
I'm here, JP.
All right. So, I'm joined by Gwyneth, McNeil, and, I'm just going to bring, let's see if I could bring Pat back in, because we, you know,
the person you have dialed can't take your call now.
See, you can't take the call now. Where are you? Life's like that. So I had a little chat there with Pat, and we were talking about all sorts of things, frequencies and the Bible and the, not really like how, we're talking about Exodus, particularly, and that it was the recording of an event. And what I was going to say was that it was all really, what we call the five books of Moses. That was like, these are the stories that that Moses could remember while they sat around the campfire waiting for the skies to clear and for them
I have I'm a Bible scholar kind of secretly, JP.
I am.
And I've recently learned that the book of Exodus was not
really
for 1,000 years after the event, 800 to 1,000 years.
Well, there you go. And it was an oral history then.
And the books of Moses, apparently none of them were written by Moses. So there was no campfire.
Well, there you go. That's my theory blown out of the water or blown out of space. So Pat, Gwyneth, all right. Back that up, Gwyneth. Why was there no campfire? I wanted my campfire. I like my campfire stories. This was Gilgamesh and his flood.
You're absolutely right. There are so many names that are transposed. It's like when I was in fifth grade, I took my first Spanish. They could not say my name. It's a very gringo name, a very Welsh English. G-W-Y does not speak with the Latin tongue. And so my name for Spanish class was Isabel. They could say that. And all across history, there are so many different people that are the same person, but with different names. So who knows who wrote what, for one thing. And I like campfires as well as anybody, you know? And who knows who sat around the campfire and made what up? You know, and for what agenda? The more I learn, the more I know I don't know, JP. That's all.
Well, you know, things just get bigger. You know, we think we know the size of the atom and all that stuff. And then, we get these micro sub atomic particles that are nano and then femto and, all this stuff, technologies that just get out of hand. So,
yeah.
So, even the stuff we know this week is going to be out of date next week because somebody's going to say, there we go. So, how are we doing with, are you back with us, Pat?
Yeah, I had gotten disconnected, but I was able to jump back in.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Skype is absolutely useless. I have to say in public, I have to say it every day, Skype is really letting us down as a race. Well, certainly as a group of broadcasters, you want to bring people into a group call. You can't do it anymore on Skype. So you have to go, have to take people into a Zoom room or somewhere like that. Anyway, working on it.
This is my first clue about Skype. Back several years ago when I first was chatting with Simon, Skype took my program out, took my computer out, just basically took all my information and destroyed it 3 times, and I finally gave up on Skype. They did not want me talking to Simon.
Yeah, they make a mess of that whole thing. So here we are, actually managed to get three people on the call. That's a current record. Gwyneth, Pat. Now.
Hello, Pat. Good to meet you, Pat.
Nice to meet you.
I hear you worked for NASA.
Yeah, not for a long time, but my family, both of my parents were NASA people. My dad was big time up there. He sat right next to Chris Kraft during the later Apollo missions, and that's a whole big tangled mess. I am down one brother because of it.
Wow.
He had all my dad's evidence, and they took him out, and they took all the evidence with them.
This is an all too familiar story. It's a sadly familiar story.
Why I'm so hesitant in a lot of ways. Also, somebody just mentioned in the chat about famous Freemasons. Who was it? Famous actors just did an Apollo something movie a while back. Tom Hanks. Yeah, I actually met Tom Hanks when he was here filming that big Apollo, whatever it was, movie. Not in any, formal way. I was at the gas station, and his limo was gassing up at the same time I was gassing up. And this was long before he was diagnosed with diabetes. And I caught him coming out of the little 7-Eleven or whatever it was, with his arms full of junk food. So when they came out of, he just said hello and I said hello and, we didn't really talk. But I found out later he was here filming that movie. And then I remembered that when it came out that he was diabetic and was quite ill years later.
Yeah. Well, you can only live for so long on the road food, and, it keeps you going. It keeps you awake, doesn't it? Eat lots of sugary foods, but, it takes its toll. It pays,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and speaking of the 33rd degree and above Freemasons, it's basically pretty well known around here that the Freemasons control, the Freemasons are Nazis and they control this area. And so what you were talking about, and what somebody in the chat was talking about, the boys from Brazil, all that stuff, as bizarre as it sounds, it's not bizarre to people that live around here. It's scary enough, though, that most of them won't talk about it.
Exactly. Ron Howard and Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
But, yeah, exactly. People say that NASA stands for never a straight answer. I say it stands for Nazis are still active.
Exactly. Thank you.
I like that.
Well, having discovered this, read this book and discovered that the Germans actually invent, the secret weapon. We always hear about, the Wunderwaffe, people destroy the world. The secret weapon that they had was a mysterious thing. And this book fell into my hands or into my consciousness, Die Glocke. And it fills in a very interesting gap, because this account is like the most secret thing. Project Giant, it was called. It was the biggest ever project, and it was the most secret. And it was a secret because they killed everybody who was working on it, apart from this guy, and there's two guys, and the people who escaped in the Bell. That they escaped into the secret tunnel work of the castle Kziaz, where the project was headed from. It had all these tunnel systems that led to the underground military bases, but there are other secret tunnels. It's the classic Baroque German castle.
I've seen some of those castles. I used to live in Bavaria, and I visited the Neuschwanstein Castle that the Disneyland Castle was modeled after. and another castle that the one that Ludwig, the Bavarian king, was raised in. They were really magical places.
Yeah, and there's this thing, and this is where they had the thing that called the henge, and so that we discover that the secret weapon that the Nazis were developing, well, actually the Glocke was a delivery system. It was like, well, basically it created a wormhole in 1943. It created a wormhole that they could detonate, they could drop a device over Washington with no warning. They were considering what to do, whether they should do a germ bomb or because they developed zombie bombs. Even then they were working using red mercury. This is this stuff they call Vril on Aldebaran. But it's the power. It's incredibly unstable, so it releases a lot of energy. Apparently you can buy this stuff on the black market as a health supplement, in really, 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 really micro tiny quantities.
That's the C60, right?
Say again?
That's the C60, right?
No. That's carbon. That's carbon 60. That's shungite. Graphene.
Shungite has C60 in it, but I recently heard that red mercury was somehow connected with that also.
Well, I wonder. That's interesting. They had this thing they called Serum 525, and it was a mixture of mercury and iron filings and thorium, and they had to boil it in a plutonium reactor. So they had to use a lot of electricity to get this thing kind of cooking. And so it was a very expensive thing to make. You needed like the entire output of a power station to make a gram. And in order to, one of these Glocke devices needed 2 tons of mercury. So, it takes a long time, and it took a lot of energy to create this power, the power cell technology. Anyway, so all these, reading about that, then it all these ideas about people with UFOs, that they're extraterrestrial were like, oh, hang on a second. If the Germans had invented this in 1943 and hadn't lost the war, which they hadn't, then there's got to be a lot of other stuff. And now we see these Hanabu devices and the TR-3B, which was developed out of it. It's all the same thing. They've probably, I don't know if they're still using the same mercury technology. Do you know about that, Pat?
Well, like I was saying, this is vague in my head, but I believe I did hear about red mercury in connection with the C60, and the connection has to do with they both allow entry to the quantum field, which is basically what I heard you describing, where they could pop something in like a wormhole. Kind of thing that a wormhole would have to do with ways to collapse time and space and work with the quantum field. But I'm not a scientist and I don't have a scientist mind, but I have heard a connection there, and it goes back, to that original alchemical thing from long, 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 long time ago.
Well, indeed. Indeed. So, because one of the things that our own scientist Walt Silver discovered is that if you mix colloidal silver with C60, with shungite powder, you end up with exactly that. It opens up to the fourth dimension. It's like puts its foot in the door. So if you were to do that with red mercury, that would be intense.
Yeah. And my information is that shungite, because it was originally a meteor, and not from, I don't think it was supposedly from this solar system even, that it has small amounts of C60 in it naturally. And so, you know, for years now, I don't, you know, all my water is filtered with shungite. And, you know, I keep it around me all the time. So I'm getting more and more. I mean, you know, I kind of learn, not just intellectually, but by a felt sense. It's that synesthesia stuff I was talking about earlier in the call. And that's my felt sense, yes, that there is a connection and that there is C60 in shungite, and that C60 is a form of carbon, like a crystal, that gets us close to or provides us interaction with the quantum field, which, you know, if you think about quantum field, that's a great place to unstick oneself from time and space and aging.
So, red mercury, Gwyneth.
Ah, I don't know much about it. I am kind of a closet scientist, though. And I am aware that red mercury is mentioned in alchemical texts a long time ago, before history, pre-Pythagorean texts. And it is given marvelous, powerful powers clear back then. And I kind of think that's why many texts, well, the description varies from text to text nowadays in traditional texts, but many call it mythical. They just simply flat out call it a mythical substance. They don't give it any credence, but they do say it possesses massive destructive power, usually, of some sort.
Exactly. You remember Simon was talking, I don't know if you do remember, but we were talking about the destruction of Meldek before.
Mm-hmm,
and,
yes.
Simon was saying, you know, there was something that happened that had an unexpected result, that the explosion was that much more intense. It blew the whole planet up.
I heard that. That
and
interested me.
I thought at the time, I wonder if they had a big stash of red mercury there.
Oh, because that'd do it.
That would, exactly, that would do it.
Boy, that would do it. Wow.
So Pat, spinning away from this planet, do you know much about off-planet history of the, you know, the real history of the human race? I mean, I know you're in Houston.
Well, I know that this is my current understanding, and that's kind of how I approach things. I'll say something, my current understanding, but if I get information tomorrow that may alter that, you know, I'll let you know. But my current understanding, at least for myself, and so I figure, you know, I'm not much different than other folks. I've been told by a half a dozen different sources who have historically shown real good access to and reading of the Akashic Records. I'm told that I originated in the Pleiadian star system. And the way it was explained to me is that you incarnate once, and it doesn't have to be on Earth. It could be basically anywhere, because life is basically everywhere. You incarnate once, and I incarnated supposedly in a specific system in the Pleiadian system, and that after that, you can move around from planet to planet or star system to star system, but it's kind of a dangerous game to play in the search of knowledge and experience. And I'm told that the soul really just wants experience. It's already perfect. It's positive. It's not, it may have, you know, both sides of a polarity within it, but it is, it's not in any way, shape, or form imperfect or negative. It's simply lacking in experience. And Source wanted, you know, it created souls because it wanted to experience itself. So supposedly where the way I was taught was that once a soul incarnates, you incarnate with a certain character from the planet that you first embody on, and that contributes to your DNA and your personality and your essence. And then you go off and explore. And you, like, I was told that I came to this planet because somebody I loved very deeply had come here exploring and had got trapped in the karmic web around the planet, and was literally had his soul being held prisoner on this planet. And that's how I came here. That particular information would have just flown over my head and not stuck with me had I not 40 years ago done some American Indian vision quests and things like that. And all this stuff they're talking about, I had in a semi-trance state drawn pictures of that I didn't understand at the time, that when I got the information many years later, it all started to make sense. So that's how come it has credibility to me. I mean, take it for what it's worth. That this is just my experience. So people, you know, go places. So you may have started out on a Lyran planet, JP, and moved to the Pleiades and then moved here. I supposedly started out in the Pleiades, have been to Sirius B, have been to, oh, gosh, a couple others. I don't remember their names right now. But the bottom line is the way I came here was I supposedly got trapped in this field around the planet and been trying to get my ass out of here ever since. So,
hence working for NASA.
I suspect that there's more of one of me that, you know, got trapped in similar ways.
Yeah, well, there's been a bit of, you know, well, here's the thing. From what I understand, there's a bit of a karmic connection here with this solar system because of the Maldek incident. You know, apparently I've been here ever since. And, apart from various holidays, they say. Anyway, but I've been here ever since and just kind of been waiting. So there was somebody had a question inside of the show. He's like, when will the Pleiadians come and contact me? And I'll be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, good luck with that, I think they say, you know, like, they're not very good at keeping in touch. Or at least when they do keep in touch, they don't let you remember it. So it's like you're not being in touch. So.
Absolutely. Let me tell you right quick. I have twice literally by physical beings who were, in one case, this gentleman was talking with the galactic something of light, the White Brotherhood people, Saint Germain, Sananda, all those guys. At the time, I didn't even know what any of that stuff meant. And he told me that they wanted to meet me, and he was communicating with them. This was like 40, 45 years ago. He was communicating with them by CB radio. And I thought, oh, well, you know, this will be fun. I had no clue what any of that was and went over there. And I'd never even made it inside the door before there was this bizarre accident, and I was nearly decapitated. And I had my neck broken, and a week later had my neck broken again by an attack by somebody in a trance state. So somebody did not want me to hook up with whoever he was talking to on his CB radio that he identified, you know, as I said. Okay, well, fast forward another 10 or 15 years, I had been sent to Kansas to meet a very famous doctor, went, and he too was in cahoots or connection and talking with on a daily basis with this same crowd of people, Saint Germain, Sananda, Ashtar, these folks. And again, I didn't know if it was real or not, but I can say that when I went to see him, he told me about all of this, and then he went home, and he said he was going to start working on my body the next day, and he was showing me all these crystals and his special machines he had and everything. And I went back to my motel and sat down, and next thing I knew, it was the next morning, 10 minutes before I was to be in his office. And while I was getting dressed, it was on the television that there was a UFO sighting about a 10 or 15 minute walk from my motel that thousands of people all over Kansas had seen. And I know something was going on because I had all that missing time, but like you say, I didn't remember a thing. Fast forward to just 3 years ago, I had another experience where I was very directly, and still am, under attack by the local Nazis. Wonder why. Anyway, I actually did meet what I believe is an in-the-flesh Canadian soldier who had been sent to protect me. And that night, he did save my life. And then he disappeared. And what was really strange about the whole experience was I was, again, before Google erased all the traces from the Internet, I was able to track this person down, and it was just a curious thing that he had the very same job as the Venusian, supposed Venusian from Stranger at the Pentagon, Valiant Thor. He had his job in real life. And he has since disappeared. But he taught me how to protect myself in certain circumstances by me just watching him protect me that evening. And coincidentally, that was a whole evening of, what's that thing where, there's time anomalies and stuff like that. Mandela effect.
Oh, yeah, the time shift effect, yeah.
Yeah, that particular evening, there was all kinds of Mandela effects going on around here. And like, some of the people that were in that meeting, they have memories of what was said and what was done. And yet, that particular evening, like in one case, this one woman that was there, she was, in most of the time, she was a red-headed, tiny little, petite, you know, skinny person who didn't wear any makeup. Yet in this particular meeting, she was 30 or 40 pounds heavier, had her hair dyed black, and was smeared with grotesque-looking makeup all over her face. And yet, seen a week later, back in her normal, everyday look, of 30, 40 pounds, she could remember everything that she said and what happened that night. So really, truly bizarre things have happened around here, but particularly about the question about Pleiadians. They are here, but they don't make themselves known because, in this, at least in this particular case, this guy was a physical being. He was not, you know, any in and out, you know, ghostly kind of person.
Well, Pleiades, the Nazis don't like them. Well, it's the same, you know, it's been the same war. And, you know, it may have been in reptilians and now it's in humanoids and it came through, the Aldebarans and all this stuff. And Aldebarans and Pleiadians, can take similar form. So they say. But do you know the story of the Aldebarans? Aldebarans? Anybody?
I have heard the story, but it was like, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, so it's not that fresh in my head.
Well, the story is that they have, there's two planets which are on opposite sides of the star Aldebaran. And there's one race who are called the Sumi, who have, particularly, they're kind of perfectionists. I suppose you could understand it, but anything that is imperfect, they schlep off to the other planet. And so they have a completely schizophrenic society. Because, you know, anybody who's imperfect, like an artist, you know, will be schlepped off to the other side. And they don't, you know, it's a kind of jungle planet. Go ahead.
That's also a recipe for creating psychopaths, because it's a judgment call as to what's inferior or not, right? And if they're the ones that are doing the judging, they're going to end up sooner rather than later being psychopaths with no conscience, because they're going to think they're superior, and the ones that are in their minds in any way defective, they're going to be the ones that they slough off to the other planet, and then eventually they're going to start thinking about them like the Khazarians do, that they're goyim and beasts and, you know, not quite human.
Exactly. Exactly. So they're the archetype of the Nazi.
Exactly. And that's how they are around here. And
you know what?
They have literally said to me, when they brought us here, they told us that we could do anything we felt like doing, and we didn't have to do anything we don't feel like doing, and it is our prerogative to manage you riffraff.
Well, there you go.
I have seen that firsthand, what Pat's talking about, because in my addiction counseling practice, over and over and over and over again, that's exactly the pattern. Yeah, what she's talking about and how it shows up with how we're called, you know, the goyim and the riffraff and all of that by that whole thing. But it's just a microcosm how it shows up in the addictions field. At least that's my experience.
Well, exactly. If you're subject to this mentality, you're right. There's going to be this terrible feeling that you're going to have to run away from all the time. And I believe that that's what addiction is about. But it's this terrible realization that you're living in hell.
Without having the words to say it. It's just...
Exactly. It's just a feeling. It's like there's no expression of it, but that's what it feels like. It feels like you're living in hell. And if you say it, it's like, oh, that's all right then. This is hell. That's fine. Let's go have fun.
Well, the only thing we can do anything about is something that has a name. I know that I have worked with, people that I know that struggle with this feeling, that don't have any idea that it's an addictive feeling at all, but it's just there. The moment they can say, oh, I am doing everything I can to try not to have this feeling, and then they own the feeling, then they're out of the addictive pattern. It doesn't have them. They have the opportunity to have it. And just like you say, oh, it's just that. Oh, it's a that. Oh, okay. All right. Now I got it identified. It has a name. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have a term for it.
Yep.
Yeah. And you've come to terms.
Yeah. Well put.
That's what it's about. You know, when you've got a term, you've got a handle. You got a name. Yeah. Oh, you. Fred. Well, you got a name. Yeah. You can manipulate. Oh, Fred, go over there. You know, you can manipulate the reality around thing around you. If there's a handle or a knob or a lever, you know, how you drive a car is through knobs and levers. But, you know, the steering wheel's just a great big knob. I better stop talking about this. it's getting too metaphorical here. But yes, indeed, you know, we're here to manipulate our universe to make it do stuff, that it didn't do before, because it needs to, because it needs to serve that moment. You know, here I am. I'm manipulating my little universe with my mixing desk and Skype, and I'm talking to you two, and I'm, running the, thing, and it, you know, it's not an evil manipulation. It's just manipulation. Well, you know, that's what we're here to do, to handle the universe around us with our 10 fingers. That's all we got to do. 10 little fingers. Pretty good. I think we do very well.
Yeah. Manipulate is a term that's had some bad press. And I think of when I go to my physical therapist and I say, okay, my arm is really hurting and I can't move it. So-and-so. And he says, oh, okay, well, we can fix that here. And yeah, it may hurt a little bit, but he knows the standard for function. Then he manipulates it to fit a standard of function that I couldn't just do by myself. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to have bad press, but it definitely has come to mean that. So I think there's a little definition on manipulation. And you and your mixing desk, I'd say that's a positive manipulation, JP.
Well, I hope so, you know. That's how music is made. And, you know, there are technicians who manipulate their devices. There you go. What can I say?
You guys, you could use the term for manipulation. You could substitute dancing, singing, touching, molding.
Performing.
To have a negative connotation. And in fact, that's kind of one of my, I think it's coincidental. I'm also a licensed addictions counselor among my other licenses. But a little bit familiar. And that's one of my kind of issues with the Alcoholics Anonymous thing. You know, hello, I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic. It's like, well, yeah, in at one time and place and in one context, yes, but let's work on, you know, redefining, yourself, because that's only been one part of you in one part of time, probably in response to one set of circumstances, but you can learn a different dance. You can sing a different song, and it doesn't have to be all negative.
Well, isn't that what we're here to do, is to sing our own song? And who is it, I forget, that said if you don't, the reason for being here is to sing our song, and you don't want to die with your song in you, unsung.
Unsung songs. So this is exactly what we're talking about. Earlier on in the show, we were talking about that we all have a frequency, that comes out when we say, it's changed now. It used to be, it's now, we give clues as to what our frequency is at any one moment completely through our voice. And I believe that there are probably, you could use the word circuits or subfunctions in our brain that can hear the subtle tones that come from the expression of what comes through somebody's voice. It's not just words that come through; it's tonal expression, it's cadence. It's like you get the feeling through it. If it's performed well, really, isn't it?
I think you get it subconsciously, whether or not you get it consciously, and whether you like it or not consciously.
You just said something exactly that I was going to say, is that there's something within us, although you said it more eloquently, there's something within us that recognizes frequency that isn't in our conscious mind. I was just going to say that, and you just said it.
Well, it's that's the cognitive.
Yeah,
the thing that, all right, so the word we very rarely hear is cognitive resonance, which is the opposite of cognitive dissonance. We hear the cognitive dissonance, and people say dissidence as well, which is, it sounds like it would be a great band name, cognitive dissonance, but no, it's a dissonance, which is when two notes are very, very close to each other, then they produce a bell-like clanging sound, often very unpleasant. So, yeah, you can hear people's subtleties, and it must be quite interesting. You probably can suss people out, Pat, there in Houston, that you can you can, you understand people like very instantly because you can hear their tonal. This is the thing, you have this tonal memory. Do you, can you identify people? Have you done remote healing?
Absolutely. And in fact, as a counselor, it's like a basic part of the NLP model is the first thing you do when you meet a patient is you have to establish trust and rapport to set a stage for real communication, because otherwise you're just BSing each other. And in order to establish trust and rapport, one has to, it's called match modeling. And if you do it elegantly, you're going to do it via a vibration. You're going to also do it by a sound. You're also going to do it by your mental image pictures. And what you, if you're going to, what you do as a counselor, at least as I understand it, is you basically, you know, look at the person, you know, you take in the person in front of you and you, bring your frequency to where they are and then slowly lift your frequency to help them get unstuck from their own, you know, cognitive dissonance or whatever you want to call it, their own stuckness, their, you know, to get them out of their reptilian brainstem and back into their heart mind where, you know, the frequencies are higher, clearer, you know, more beautiful and more in sync with who a person is on in a multidimensional way. Because there's a lot of people on this planet, I think, seems to me anyway, that are can be really, really messed up, you know, on a casual look. But if you can look and see them on the other dimensions, non-physical dimensions, they can be saints and sadducees and, you know, great souls. But you, if you don't get to know them by making music with them vibrationally, and to me, that's what a good therapeutic relationship is all about. Now, that, you know, sounds nice, but it's also hard to, you know, to take one's own frequency and lower it, you know, if somebody's in a really dark, dark place. And then there's also the risk of taking on other people's, you know, negative energy, you know, because it's like water. It kind of flows. And if it flows from them to you, then you have to be able to go out and, you know, clean it off of you. But, yeah, that's what I think. It's a lot of it is when people's judgments get in the way that they end up, you know, getting trapped in these dark places, I'll say.
Beth, would you like to speak to that? How do you prevent yourself from getting to a dark place with the person that you are, you know, how do you prevent catching the stuff that they're in?
I know how I do it. I used to have a real problem with that until I really started using some of what I teach. Because I haven't done the NLP specifically as Pat has, but I am a hypnotherapist and a trainer, and I've done that for years. And when I would use that in conjunction with actually literally saying, okay, source, I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be with the client. You take care of me. Then I didn't have a problem anymore. It took me years to get to that point. But it, in fact, I wish I'd done it sooner. But it was just that one little thing. So I was really having problem having exactly the trouble that Pat was saying. Hey, it is really hard, especially for a heartful person to be with a person and not get their stuff all over you.
Exactly. Well, so I'm sorry, Pat.
I think you cannot totally not do that, but energy is making a good point. She's saying don't match the person's frequency and then raise yours. Maintain your own frequency and give the person a frequency they can match. Well, that's how I give a person a frequency they can match is by demonstrating, you know, lowering the frequency and then bringing it back up and then bringing them along with me, if that makes any sense to energy in any case. And it's not that I give them a frequency. It's more like the notion of establishing and maintaining rapport. And usually I know that it's working because sooner or later the person's going to make some kind of comments about, you know, I don't know what it is, but I just feel better after I've talked with you.
Don't you love it when that happens?
And it isn't anything that we talk about because I get super criticized all the time. I've actually been fired from jobs by nurses who have referred patients to me because they didn't like them and they wanted to punish them, so they referred them for counseling. And this one nurse recently came by and heard me talking with the patient, and she got all furious and went to the owner and demanded that I be fired because she had referred that patient because they were causing trouble. And here she overheard us talking, and we were laughing and having a good time. And counseling's supposed to be all about crying and being miserable. You know, I think she's totally wrong, but I know that a lot of people do have that sense that counseling is supposed to be the counselor sits there and you tell them all your problems and you get it off your chest and you cry and beat your head, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true.
I would be surprised if that isn't why people don't go. At least they have a hard time going. Counseling is just not, oh, no, 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 let's not do that. It has a bad rap.
But it also leaves the therapist vulnerable because then, you know, you're open to being criticized. Well, you're not talking about the things you're supposed to talk about. Or this is also, and if a person is a Wendy Weiner, you know, if you let them talk, if I let them talk and whine and whine and whine every time in session, what they're going to end up doing is reinforcing their own Wendy Weiner identity. And they're going to get more stuck, not less stuck. So, you know, that's where creativity comes in. And it's like energy was saying, I mean, you know, the idea is to bring up the vibration, but to not to, like, give them something from me, but to empower them to reach for a higher frequency themselves, even on just a felt or subconscious sense.
There's a key word. That's a key word.
I feel better after we visited.
To empower them, there's the key.
Yeah. So I don't like it that in the AA things, you know, I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I want to hear I'm Joe and I've had that experience and I'm working my way out of it and feeling better every day. That's what I'd like to hear.
I like to hear that. Directly after they have finished owning and giving a name to their experience and actually owning.
Oh, absolutely. Totally agree with you. Because if you can't identify a negative habit, which is what addictions are, I think if you can't identify it and you can't put a circle around it, you know, you can't put boundaries around it, then you don't know what to take apart. You don't know what you're dealing with. So, yeah, I totally agree.
So, now, I'd love to keep going, but we can't. We're running out of time and they're running out of show. I'd like to say thank you, both of you. Who's got websites if you want to publicize yourself? Does anybody else want to talk? Do you want to talk to anybody else?
Oh, no, I'll just talk to JP. That's all right.
Well, I don't have a website, so that'll be easy. I'm just me.
Pat?
JP, I did good to today.
She did. Yes, that's all right. All right. So, look, I hope you haven't said anything that has gotten you into deeper hell than we already are in. But may it be short-lived, if at all. you come back on, and it's always fun to have you in the chat room. You always you have a thing, there. Everybody knows you. Gwyneth, you should come over more often.
I will, JP. Thanks for the invite.
Thanks for coming to the little campfire. Good night, everybody. Beyond.